Welcome to Elite Wrestling Radio. I'm Hotshot Danny Duggan, and we're back with our weekly podcast series. And what a big week ahead of Canadian Wrestling's Elite. At this time, next Wednesday, we'll be kicking off our fifth anniversary Masterpiece Theater Tour, headlined by former WWE superstar, the Masterpiece Chris Masters. Five shows, 5 days. Neepawa, Morden, Winnipeg, Selkirk, and Bossier. We're in for 5 big days of professional wrestling, wrestlers coming in from across Western Canada, the Midwestern United States, as far as the Southern United States. This is going to be the biggest CWE tour to date, and we're really looking forward to it. Some of those matches that are going to be taking place, we'll run those down very quickly here, as there's quite a few that have been announced. In Neepawa, next Wednesday, February 19th, Kevy Chevy, former CWE Tag Team Champion, will take on Chris Masters in the main event. Also scheduled on the card, Man will do battle in a no countouts, no disqualification match with myself, Hotshot Danny Duggan, and the big sexy beast, AJ Sanchez. Also scheduled, The Gift, Jason Kincaid, in his first CWE appearance, will take on Kamikaze. Matt Sigmund, coming all the way in from Knoxville, Tennessee, will challenge first all-star Brian Rich. And Heavy Metal will do battle with the Rebel Bobby Collins. Also announced for that card in Neepawa, the Mohican Sun, Jess Youngblood, challenges the 300-plus-pound monster, Cannibal. Then we roll into Morden. The next night, the Morden Access Center, Thursday, February 20th, for our first event there since last May, and we got a really jam-packed card on deck. Chris Masters will take on Kamikaze. I'll take on the big sexy beast, AJ Sanchez. The Gift, Jason Kincaid, taking on one half of the CWE Tag Team Champions, Tommy Lee Curtis. Blake Broadway, Mr. Incredible, collectively known as Man, will take on the Mohican Sun, Jess Youngblood, and his new tag team partner, Billy Blaze, in a no countouts, no disqualification match. And also scheduled, Sigmund takes on former CWE TV champion, the Rebel Bobby Collins. Heavy Metal versus Brian Rich. And many other favorites, including Jethro Hogg, Morden's Own, and much, much more. And then we roll in to Winnipeg, Manitoba, where it all began 5 years ago for Canadian Wrestling's Elite for a big 10-match card next Friday, February 21st. On that card, CWE Championship defended in the main event, Last Man Standing. Robbie Royce defends his title against the Tattoo Terminator, Darren Dalton. Chris Masters takes on beautiful Bobby J. Myself, Hotshot Danny Duggan, will be taking on Heavy Metal in a rematch from the finish of the Rumble to Remember in December. The CWE TV Championship will be on the line as Anderson Tyson Moore defends against John Cutler in his first singles match in Winnipeg in over 2.5 years. Also scheduled on this night, Sigmund from Knoxville, Tennessee, the NWA Mountain Empire Champion, takes on former CWE Champion, the big sexy beast, AJ Sanchez. The Gift, Jason Kincaid, takes on Mentolo in his first match back with CWE, fresh off his WWE evaluation. We had two of the continent's two best junior heavyweights squaring off for the first time. Also scheduled, the CWE Tag Team Championships will be defended in a four-way tag team title elimination match. The champions, the Saints of Los Angeles, Tommy Lee Curtis and Nate Hardy, defend against Big Jess and Billy Blaze, Man, Blake Broadway, Mr. Incredible, and the Sons of Anarchy, Mike Mission and Cliff Corleone. Also on the docket that night, the Stefan Epic and the coach Kelly Russell taking on the Rebel Bobby Collins. There will be a 6-way, one fall to a finish, number one contenders match for the TV title. The Blue-Eyed Idol, Tyler Colton versus Kamikaze versus Kevy Chevy versus the German juggernaut Moses Luke versus first all-star Brian Rich and the Monster Cannibal. Also scheduled that night, in a match where if Dick Blood wins, he gets 5 minutes alone with the mastermind Kevin Cannon. It'll be Dick Blood with Bobby Collins in his corner to watch his back, taking on the rabid dog Rob Stardom with Kevin Cannon in his corner. So that wraps up Winnipeg, a big show on deck, probably the biggest to take place here in the city of Winnipeg. And then we'll roll into Selkirk the next night, the Steel City, where the Masterpiece, Chris Masters, will take on the alpha male former CWE heavyweight champion, Matt Fairlane, in the main event. ATM, if he retains his CWE TV title the night before in Winnipeg, will defend against super friend JJ Sanchez. and Heavy Metal will cash in his win from the Rumble to Remember and get a shot at the winner of Darren Dalton versus Robbie Royce the night before in Winnipeg. And myself, Hotshot Danny Duggan, will be taking on Blake Broadway. The Gift, Jason Kincaid versus the First All-Star, Brian Rich. Kamikaze versus the Rabid Dog, Rob Stardom. The Mohican Sun, Big Jess versus Sigmund, and much more. And then we finalize the tour. Beaujolais, special afternoon show, Sunday, February 23rd. The Masterpiece, Chris Masters, squares off with super friend JJ Sanchez. The Mohican Sun, Jess Youngblood, takes on Son of Anarchy member Big Cliff Corleone in a battle of the big men. Also on deck, The Gift, Jason Kincaid versus current CWE Tag Team Champion, Murder City Saint, Nate Hardy. I'll be taking on the German juggernaut Moses Luke, who will have Ava in his corner. The Big Sexy Beast, AJ Sanchez, will be teaming with Kamikaze to wrestle Sigmund and the Blue-Eyed Idol, Tyler Colton. And Heavy Metal, who very well could be the CWE Heavyweight Champion come Beaujolais on Sunday, will take on Billy Blaze. For full event tour information, go to our website, cwecanada.ca, or like us on Facebook, CWE Wrestling, and all that information is at your access. CWE TV, this Friday night, we're getting close to the anniversary show, so things are heating up on the TV program, and we've got a big TV episode this Friday night, 9:30 Central Time, Channel 30 on MTS, 592 on Bell Express View. In the main event, the current CWE champion, the Pissed Off Pitbull, Robbie Royce, takes on the High Impact Wrestling champion, the legendary Rex Roberts. Also scheduled on this night, the Alpha Male, Matt Fairlane, teaming with John Cutler in what was his first match back. After his 2.5 year hiatus, they'll be teaming up to take on the German juggernaut Moses Luke and A-list Anderson Tyson Moore. Also on the program, Darren the Bomb Dalton, in preparation for his match with Robbie Royce at the anniversary show, will be taking on the Super Friends in a handicap contest. Next week, we return to the air with our weekly podcast series. It was supposed to happen this week, but I got bumped till next week so we can get Chris Masters on the line today. I'll be sitting down with our social media superstar, Tyler James, our host of ceremonies at most of our CWE events, to conduct an interview with myself. So we're going to take a short break. We're going to get the Masterpiece Chris Masters on the line, and we're going to get this rocking and rolling. Stay tuned. And we're back on Elite Wrestling Radio, and at this time, we're joined by a man that was supposed to be with us yesterday afternoon. He was feeling a little under the weather, but he's feeling good today. Welcome to the show, Chris Masters.
What's going on, guys? Sorry about yesterday.
You feeling better today?
Oh, I feel great, man. I feel great. I was just a little under the weather. You know how it goes. But today's a new day, man. What's going on?
Well, you're in sunny Los Angeles. We're currently in the middle of a snowstorm here in Winnipeg, where you're coming up for 5 days. Are you ready for the worst Canadian winter in many, many years?
Oh, my God. Man, I'm glad you reminded me, actually. Remember, I was telling you I need to get a set of gloves because I only have one glove, and I don't want to be rocking it like Michael Jackson out there or have to rock the one glove and one hand in a pocket. So I'm going to have to bring scarves, earmuffs, the whole shebang, man. It's like the North Pole over there.
Yeah, it's been miserable. Things are going to heat up. We're going to have some fun next week. You're here for 5 shows in 5 days with Canadian Wrestling's Elite. So we're going to get our fans familiar there. They definitely know who the Masterpiece Chris Masters is, but let's get a little in-depth and find out the history of the man that is the Masterpiece. Were you a fan of professional wrestling growing up?
Oh, yeah, of course, man. I loved it my whole life, pretty much. I mean, ever since I was, say, 6, 7 years old, I came up on, either Team Warrior or Team Hogan when I started watching him. I was a Team Warrior guy.
And did you go to a lot of live events as a young child growing up, or was it strictly watching on television?
Well, I grew up watching Superstars and Challenge, if you remember that, where they would always have the unnamed guys versus the superstars, and, you know, it was nothing like the current wrestling product. So I grew up on that, and... What was the question? I'm sorry, repeat it.
If you attended live events growing up, or were you strictly watching through television?
Well, I watched those, and then finally I did get to see a live event, and it was, I believe, in 2000, or no, it was 1996, right after Sean had won the title. We went to see a house show over at the Arrowhead Pond in Anaheim, And I remember it's the Attitude Adjustment Tour, and I was sitting actually right along the aisleway, so I got to slap hands with all the wrestlers, and I mean, it was just so cool for me, man. It was so awesome.
Many guys you probably ended up working with many years later.
Oh, yeah, many, many. I mean, I remember Shawn Michaels wrestled Vader on that card. I remember Mick Foley was on. Well, I can't remember all the matches, but I remember it was Shawn and Vader for the title. And then, you know, there were a few others. But, yeah, a lot of those guys ended up being my peers about 10 years later, which was, you know, obviously mind-blowing when I first came to WWE. And it's a great honor to get to work with some of the guys I idolized.
So fast forward a couple of years, you went from a fan of professional wrestling. What made you make the decision to then get involved with the profession?
I think I was just so obsessed with it, and I loved it so much. And by the time I was 16 years old, I started pondering the question of what was I going to do with my life. And it wasn't a very tough decision. You know, it was really, I mean, I just, like, narrowed it down. It's like, well, what do I have a passion for? What do I love? And, I mean, literally, that was the guy in second period with the wrestling mag, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and throwing my friends in the lockers. So, I mean, all fingers pointed towards pro wrestling. And, you know, the question was, did I have the tools? I knew I had good height. I was a skinny, tall, skinny kid, but, you know, I started wrestling school at 16, and I obviously learned pretty quick. I had to fill out and do all those things, which I think I probably knew. I mean, I grew up on the 80s, so, I mean, you remember how all those guys were. Warrior, Hogan, Warlord, I mean, everybody was so larger than life, such big guys. So, you know, that was kind of my story. I decided at 16 I was going to do it. Figured I kind of had the tools, but, you know, I had a lot of work ahead of me in terms of learning to wrestle and obviously developing my body as well.
I was reading an interesting bit about you that said you started wrestling and then you actually took time away from it to focus on your body. What at a young age, you know, bestowed upon you this idea to make that mature decision to step away, get your body ready to take it seriously and take it to the next level?
Well, I was kind of forced into it, but it was, you know, exactly what happened was I was about 2 months into training at 16 years old, and I tried to leapfrog this guy named Andrew Bernardsky, who people might know from the movie The Program, and he also played Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw movies, but he's a big dude. He's not very coordinated, though, so, I mean, he was really a liability in the ring, and so I tried to leapfrog him. I couldn't clear him. I landed on my ankle. I fractured my ankle. I remember I still wrestled on it for a couple months, or at least I was training on it, and then finally I got it checked out, and I had to have surgery because I had a fracture and bone debris. So that's when I kind of thought to myself, I'm 16 years old. I'm not going to, you know, John Cena actually, and he started the same day, and then there was this other guy named Basil. I basically got a taste for exactly for what WWE was looking for. You know, they wanted to see that you had, you know, some charisma, some athletic ability in the ring, and that you were built. So, I mean, after I got hurt, I realized at 16 I wasn't going to get signed, and that I was probably wasting money and, you know, just going at it too early. So I took 2 years off after I had the surgery. I just focused. I took up bodybuilding as a hobby. You know, I never competed in a show or anything like that, but I took it up as a hobby, and I just started training like crazy, and all with the goal in mind, though, of making a return when the time was right, which, you know, ended up being at 19. So it was about maybe 2 to 3 years from the point I got injured to when I came back. But it was to mature, you know, not just physically, but mature as a person as well. We come in there really ready to actually, you know, possibly get signed by WWE and ready to, you know, start my career.
How soon was it you came back? After you came back from training, did you get the WWE call?
I spent about a year at UPW because, I mean, I came back and I was physically primed. I mean, and, you know, in comparison to most guys my build, I mean, I was athletic still, you know, because I didn't move like a bodybuilder. I wasn't robotic, and I wasn't clunky or you know, anything like that. So, you know, I was on their radar pretty early. I'd say from the first time I saw them, you know, they were looking at me, but they weren't convinced. They just kept tabs on me for a while. And so finally, you know, it just came out of the blue, out of nowhere. You know, I got contacted by Rick Bassett, who runs UPW, kind of giving me the heads up without actually telling me. And then I actually got the call from John Laurinaitis when I was hired. So, you know, it's been a seed that was planted, but, you know, kind of with WWE, it seems to always have worked out like that. Whenever you least expect it, they call. Even the second time around when I got rehired, I mean, I wasn't anticipating it at the point they did. You know, like, you know, some time had gone by, and you start to think that, oh, you know, maybe they're not interested or whatever, and then boom, out of nowhere, they call you.
So the dream comes true. You get the call. At 19 years old, you pack up your life and you move to Louisville, Kentucky. What was going on in your mind at this stage in your life?
I figured I'd lived in L.A. my whole life when I was 19 years old at the time. So it was scary. And I figured it might be culture shock and, you know, going from L.A. to Louisville, obviously very different. But at the same time, it was obviously to pursue my dreams, so that outweighed any kind of anxiety about leaving or anything like that. There wasn't really a choice. And when I went down there, it wasn't really, you know, Louisville is a great city, actually, but, you know, it was the group of individuals at OVW that really made it such a great time. It was basically the equivalent of my college. I mean, I didn't make a lot of friends in Kentucky outside of OVW. It's like we had our own little fraternity, and, you know, you did different things out of Louisville. Like, you know, I dated a few girls from Kentucky and all that, but most of my interaction was just with our group, you know, like Matt Morgan, Mickey J, Johnny Jeter, Muhammad Hassan. I mean, there was a lot of others, but we had such a tight-knit group, and it was like college. We all went out together. We all hung out together. We all lived in these complexes that were across the street. You either were at Cypress Hill or Mallard Point, I think it was, or Mallard Creek. Mallard Creek or Cypress Point. So it was like we had a little fraternity of about 30 people, and we all hung out. And there wasn't too many, there wasn't too much type stuff or anything like that either. So, I mean, it was a great experience. I mean, I'll always look at that like it was my last few years of innocence in the wrestling business before going to WWE, you know, where everything becomes very serious and, you know, money's on the line. I mean, that's when everything starts pretty much.
What was the biggest culture shock and adjustment for you going from Los Angeles to Louisville, Kentucky?
Well, I wouldn't say anything in terms of the actual, like, city itself. I mean, you know, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. Let's put it that way. When I heard Louisville, I didn't figure that it would be such a well-developed city. I mean, they had really good gyms, actually, surprisingly. Gyms that would even match up to some out here in L.A. I mean, movie theaters in the gym. I mean, it was just crazy. But I think, you know, the biggest thing that stood out when I went to Louisville, that was my learning lesson, wasn't necessarily Louisville or... It was more the learning wrestling etiquette, you know, like, you know, as a fan my whole life, and that's one thing, but when you come into wrestling, there's an etiquette that, a kind of unwritten rule book that you need to learn, and if you don't, you know, you're going to do things that make people mad and upset people, and you're going to get yourself what they call a quote-unquote heat. So, and that was a lot of my problems coming in, is I didn't know the etiquette, and I did a lot of things to piss people off unintentionally. And, you know, I was probably a kind of a cocky 19-year-old kid, I imagine, too, so that didn't help.
Who was the most influential in helping mold the masterpiece, Chris Masters, while in Louisville, and getting you on the right track?
You know, there's been a number of people throughout my whole career, but if we're going to pin down Louisville specifically, I would say, you know, Rick Rogers was amazing. Rogers was great because he really taught you the fundamentals of how to be able to go out there and work a match on the fly and be able to do an hour Broadway and really more kind of like, you know, the old school style, which is a great foundation, even though it's not used on Raw or SmackDown nowadays because the matches are like 5 minutes long. So Rick Rogers is really good to learn the foundation, but then I'll also give a lot of credit to Lance Storm when he came in eventually, because they ended up hiring Lance Storm and Bill DeMott maybe a year into my Louisville stay, and Lance Storm kind of really refined our training to what we were going to be doing in today's day and age as far as wrestling. We focused it a lot more on matches and hitting time cues and, you know, like just going out there and being able to work a match in the time that you're probably, in the time you're likely going to get in the TV and being able to hit that time. Because, you know, we were kind of at that point in our training where we needed that, you know, because Rick really laid down the foundation, but now we needed to be ready for what we were actually going to have to do at that, you know, for today's day and age of wrestling.
It wasn't long after that that you started to go on the road with WWE. You debuted on their television. It must have been quite an adjustment as it was going from Los Angeles to Louisville, Kentucky, and living life on your own. Tell us about the adjustment period of now going on the road and dealing with the fame that comes with that and the stress and the travel and everything that comes along with the territory.
Well, I mean, it was surreal. I mean, again, you know, it was a dream come true. So for me, my whole time in Louisville, I'd always imagine, like, wow, what's my theme is it going to be? And what's, you know, this is before my character got developed, what's my name going to be? And, like, you know, all that stuff. But, it was really cool. I mean, it was also very stressful, though, because, I mean, I came into a locker room of guys basically from the generation before me. So there were most of the guys are guys I kind of grew up watching, so it was intimidating. And, you know, I had some problems in terms of wrestling etiquette that would get me in trouble with some of the guys. And some of it, though, to be honest, was just, you know, there was obviously some jealousy at the beginning, but it's understandable. You know, guys work hard and are up there, and then a new guy gets caught up, and then they just put the machine behind them. So there's always some resentment that comes with that. So I had to face, like, you know, some of those obstacles coming in, which made it tough. And plus, I wasn't 100% ready to be called on the road. I mean, I did good. I could work with guys who were better than me and have matches, but I couldn't necessarily have a good match with somebody of my talent or lesser than, you know, like I wasn't at that point. I was too green. But I mean, you know, luckily I got to work with a lot of guys, you know, like Shawn Michaels, like Val Venus, and, you know, they really were able, they were very helpful, and they were able to mask and also teach me how to be confident and how to be able to call a match and all that stuff, you know.
Was there anyone specifically that was very vocal about having resentment for the push you received coming directly to TV?
No, I mean, it came with more with guys just messing with you, you know, like JBL. They, you know, they tried to, for lack of better terms, mindfuck you is what they try to do, you know, like a lot of times. So, like, you know, they're trying to test you, but at the same time, they're trying to break you down, you know what I mean? It's because, you know, if you don't have thick skin or you don't really want this, I mean, I've seen, there's been times where people have just walked out and quit because they can't handle it. But, I mean, the atmosphere isn't really like that in WWE as much nowadays. But when I first came in, it was still, you know, it was old school. I mean, that's how it was. I mean, you didn't just get welcomed in with a red carpet. I mean, you know, guys fuck with you, they test you, they want to see how you're going to react. And, you know, a lot of how you react is how they're going to handle you going further, you know.
How long did this go on for?
Bob Hart was another one who was tough on me. They'll admit it to this day, but, you know, me and him get along now. I mean, it was just, I did some things to put myself in a situation for him to hate me, you know, quite frankly, and for him to think that I didn't respect the business, you know, which was a big question to a lot of people and fans. But I mean, again, I grew up loving this as a kid. So to me, the thought of not respecting anybody, any one of those guys, including Bob Holly, or it doesn't matter who it is, from top to bottom, I respected all of them. So giving off that impression really, it sucked, and I hated it. And, you know, it made life real tough for me, and it was kind of unbelievable that I was, you know, I couldn't believe I was even going through it. I was like, you know, why can't these guys understand that, you know, I do respect every one of them, and, you know, I'm more than likely, I was just so, you know, so freaked out to be amongst all of them initially, you know what I mean? It's just an intimidating atmosphere. So, you know, it's like I missed shaking his hand one time, and then I remember his first instance with me was I missed an OVW TV, and because I didn't see my name on the card, which, you know, in wrestling now, you know, you don't, that doesn't mean you don't show up. But then I had no idea. So, I mean, he had some things on file with me for him already hating me, and it got to the point where he even really wanted. He was trying to switch a dark match from he was supposed to wrestle Carlito. He was trying to switch it to me so he could literally stiff me up, rough me up a little bit, and teach me a lesson. But thank God that never happened.
So how long did it take for them to start welcoming you?
You know, it's just one of those things. It's one of those things I tell guys when it comes to etiquette or at least at that point in wrestling, it's like you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. You can't tell everybody what the do's and don'ts are in pro wrestling. It's like you may make a mistake a couple of times, somebody smarts you up, and then you got to figure it out. If you don't figure it out, you're going to get eaten up alive.
So you mentioned Carlito. He's no stranger to Canadian Wrestling's Elite. He's done many of tours with us up here. He's quite popular up in Winnipeg, Manitoba. He's somebody you did form a partnership in World Wrestling Entertainment with. How did that partnership come to be, and what's your relationship with him today?
I still talk to that guy on a daily basis. I mean, we literally, we're weekend warriors. We usually are wrestling weekends, and then during the week, we'll be playing PS4 against each other. But, we started traveling together back then, and then they paired us up, and, we kind of had a natural chemistry together, and that's actually kind of developed over the years. And some of the best times I've had in the business are with him. I mean, we've made some situations that could be, horrible or just horrible experiences. We've made into awesome, and he's just one of the funniest, wittiest dudes I know. So, it was a lot of fun back then. It's even more fun now because I see him so much on the indies. We're on so many shows put together it's fun to be outside of the WWE 10 and be able to hang out and let loose and not have to be on that grind and reflect.
It wasn't long after you began your run with World Wrestling Entertainment, you were quickly put into main events, and one of those big main events was for the world title against Kurt Angle and John Cena. Tell us about that added pressure, not only being new to the company, but now having to deliver a main event for the world title.
I don't remember that being my most... I know the world title was on the line, which you think would make it more pressure, but I can think of a number of matches that were more stressful than even that. They were always exciting but stressful too, considering being as new as I was. For instance, I remember a time where Carlito and me teamed up against Sean and who was his partner? I'm trying to think. Maybe Kurt Angle and Mike the Tornado match. It was the last Raw they had on Spike, but the whole thing seemed like a complete clusterfuck. But luckily we got to the back and everybody was applauding. And so, that was a match that stood out as a lot of pressure. And then, of course, the Elimination Chamber match, never being involved in those was a lot of pressure. And the match you pointed out in particular was a lot of pressure, too. But I worked both of those guys. More so Cena than Angle. And we'd also worked that triple threat before on house shows. So, I don't look at it as one of the most pressure I've ever felt for an individual match, although it was definitely an exciting match to be a part of.
You stepped away from professional wrestling for some personal reasons in 2006, and then when you returned to the company, it was definitely in a smaller role than it was before you had left. How was that mentally to deal with that adjustment of going from the top of the card to now having to pretty much start from the bottom and work your way back up?
It was real tough, especially at first, because I wasn't used to that. When I first came in, I didn't have to pitch ideas. I didn't have to do anything. Everything was kind of laid out for me. Like the Masterpiece gimmick had already developed in OVW, and then came up with the Master Lock. Once I got called up, and so everything kind of fell into place, and then they gave me the push. The second time around, after about a year or so, I realized that, I didn't have the support I had last time, and I didn't have the machine. So I just made it my personal goal, if nothing else, to go out there and really just let my work speak for itself and work on becoming the best possible worker that I could become. It's a criticism I always hated because I always got the stigma that fans thought I was like the ultimate warrior type or just this guy who came in, and was a body and didn't have any kind of wrestling skills or couldn't put on a good match. And so I made that my personal mission, and so every week I went out there, and most of the time it was on Superstars, but I took pride in going out there every night and working my ass off and then picking up a part every week and seeing what I was doing right and what I was doing wrong and getting feedback from Arn Anderson and Booker T in particular. And I really evolved in my last 2 years, and I think that when they, by the time they released me in 2011, I can confidently say I was one of the top 10 best workers in that company. I mean, I could have a good match with anybody on the card, pretty much. Decent, if not good, if not great at that point, just because I'd grown so comfortable. You know, my selling had improved. I started to understand the art of what we do and the art of storytelling and all that stuff that they preach early on that you don't necessarily understand. All that stuff was starting to click. So, and if you look at my last 2 years, granted, most of it on Superstars, but you can kind of see the evolution of me going from being, you know, mediocre to having probably some of the best matches of my career within my last year. The one great thing about Superstars also, though, is you were given time. I mean, it wasn't the big show, like it wasn't Raw or SmackDown, but I mean, I was able to go out there sometimes and have 2-segment matches or 15-minute matches, 17-minute matches, and those are the matches you can really get emotionally invested in, and those are the ones where you really learn what, you know, what work is all about, and controlling emotions of the people, and just the whole thing. I mean, that was really beneficial to me. So, you know, that was kind of how I handled the situation as far as my second run. I mean, I just basically told myself, you know, if they don't have any plan to use me, I'm just going to do whatever I can to make them use me, you know, if that's what it comes down to. Obviously, it didn't work like that. And, you know, maybe I should have done a YouTube video like Zack Ryder. But, you know, in hindsight, I wouldn't do anything different. Like, I'm very proud of my last 2 years of work, even though I wouldn't have any program or storyline.
Your work at the time definitely was top-notch. You still look great. Why do you think there was resistance to put you back in a featured role?
You know, you never know. It could be, well, you know, Hunter was always, especially towards the end, he was a great outlet for me, and he had spoken to me several times about a push and repackaging, and he became my go-to guy. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it was maybe after a certain point they just figured they didn't know what to do with me, or maybe there is someone in the chain of command just didn't like me. You kind of never know. I mean, it could just come down to one person. You know, I mean, what can you do at this point? I mean, I kind of figured by the time, I mean, 2 weeks before they released me, I was already contemplating quitting the company myself, because I already figured, I was like, you know, they need baby faces right now. My work is, you know, top. This is the best I've ever been in the ring. They're not going to use me now. They're never going to use me. But then again, at the same time, on the flip side, I was like, you know, how can I justifiably quit the job that I dreamed of having and that I've always wanted? So that kind of outweighed the option of quitting. So I was like, well, let me stick it out. And then, you know, unfortunately, 2 weeks later, then that's when I got the news. So, I mean, you know, not that it would have mattered if I would have quit or got released, but, you know, there's no good real explanation. I mean, from what I was told, I was in line for a push, and they had noticed the improvement that I had made, and Hunter specifically. And this wasn't me seeking anybody out. This was several times Hunter approaching me. So it caught me by surprise. It did. And I don't have a good explanation for it, but, you know, you can never say never. I may be back there, maybe I won't, but, you know, it was what it was. I mean, you know, I just got to let it go now and keep moving on. And, you know, I've been doing quite well since I left there, so I'm not disgruntled or anything like that about the situation.
So eventually the call did come. Where were you when the call came, and how did you take it, having the dream job you aspired to have your whole life come to an end?
I think it was a shock. I mean, you know, I think the first time wasn't as surprising because I had a lot of personal issues. The second time, you know, I figured that if I were to be released, it would have been because I had done something to mess up. But, you know, I hadn't done anything. I hadn't a drug test or anything like that. So that's kind of what surprised me the most. Is I just figured, wow, you know, like I didn't bring this upon myself. And I figured if I ever got this call, it would have probably been of my fault or something I did. Which, for all I know, maybe I did do something, you know, but I know it wasn't anything in terms of, you know, a drug testing or mouthing off to anybody or a bad attitude or anything like that.
Well, you definitely picked up right where you left off. You came onto the independent scene and you've been in high demand ever since. Some of the experiences you've taken part in since then was Ring Ka King in India. How did your involvement with that company come to be, and what are some of your memories from wrestling over there?
That came to be Jeff Jarrett contacted me about that, and basically the idea was is they casted, you know, they wanted to bring in American talent that was able to work with guys that they were casting in India that had no wrestling experience, but obviously had either a look or a good character or brought something to the table. And they had Nick Dinsmore go out to India for about 3 months and train these guys before we actually shot. So it was really fun being out there with the crew we had: Luke Gallows, Trevor Murdoch, Nick Dinsmore, Mickey James came out, Matt Morgan, Abyss. I mean, great group of guys. The challenging part was they were so far as being able to pull off some, you know, at least passable matches with them, you know, matches that weren't bad. They weren't great, but they weren't bad. And the production was also great, which made up for a lot of that. So, you know, the challenge was just working with those guys. And
was there any language barrier?
You know, they were, there was language barrier too, but they spoke some English. You know, it wasn't impossible to communicate with them. But, you know, everything had to be kept very basic for them. They all did well for the most part. It's, you know, we can't take all the credit for leading them. I mean, they followed, but it was challenging in terms of the fact that, you know, they didn't like stiff contact, and that was becoming an issue. And, you know, we're not, guys have been doing this as long as we have, you know, we're not really going to tolerate that. It's one thing if you get hit, it's another thing if you get injured. So, you know, if you come back and things went well and, you know, you might have took a stiff shot and you're bitching about it, like, we didn't take time to that. So that was part of the challenge. That was one of the many challenges with those guys. But it all turned out great, and it was a good experience. And it was cool going to India, not that we really got to leave the hotel much. Unfortunately, Harry Smith got really bad food poisoning and ended up in the hospital, but as you know, he's okay. And the rest is history.
So to your knowledge, why did the promotion not carry on? Why has it come to an end?
You know, it's hard to say. I don't really know. I'm not on the inside of that. I mean, I know it was on the top network in India, and I know that their population is ridiculous. I don't know if the triples R's or something like that, but it's they have a lot of people. But I guess when it comes down to it, there might not be a lot of money. I mean, you know, so if I was to suspect something, I would suspect that, you know, they talk out here, at least in America, not Canada necessarily, about the equality gap as far as money. I mean, I'm sure as bad as it is here, it's probably much worse even in India. So, I mean, if you only got, you know, at 1% that can actually spend money to watch wrestling or for products or, you know, to put on shows, I mean, you know, the odds are against you. But I don't know if that was specifically the reason. You know, there were talks of doing another one. There was talks of doing another one in another country even. So, you know, I can't really say what happened with that, to be honest.
It was only a few short months after your experience in India, you actually did a dark match for TNA. How did the match go, and why have you not carried on with the company since then?
the match was great. I mean, for a four-minute match, that is. I worked Robbie E., and the most notable parts of the match, I guess, I didn't know how the TNA crowd was going to respond to me, and luckily for me, they were, once I made my entrance, they gave me a pop, which I was humbled by. I was like, okay, that's awesome. Like, they were solidly behind me, And we worked a pretty solid four-minute match. I mean, it was a dark match before the show, and everything worked out good. The finish worked out good. And I left there with the impression that I was going to be hired. I sat down with Hulk Hogan, and his son had even called me after I had left the tapings, letting me know that I left an impression and that I'd probably be back there. So, but one thing I've learned from wrestling is, you don't get ahead of yourself. And, so even with all that being said, I was like, well, if they do sign me, cool. If they don't sign me, that's also fine, because the fact that there's a lot of things that go with TNA, too, in terms of me. Like, I stay booked pretty darn regularly on my own and make at least decent money just working on my own. So the only big benefit really to TNA would be the TV exposure, because it's always good to be on TV to stay relevant. But, basically, I don't know ultimately what happened. Again, it could have been one person in the chain of command, but I was under the impression I'd be working there. But at the same time, it's fine that I'm not, because, with some of the things that they've done over the last year in terms of not letting talent work, shows outside of theirs that are being filmed and whatnot, I mean, that would hurt me in the end. And when it comes down to it, the only place if you really want to make money in this business, the only place you can really make money is WWE. I mean, TNA is a great place and all, but I don't think you're going to get rich there unless you're maybe, a couple guys at the top, possibly. So, it was an opportunity, but, it wasn't a make-or-break thing. I wasn't devastated. It was like, if it happens, cool. If it doesn't, cool. I'll move on and keep doing what I'm doing.
So you're staying busy on the independents, and with independent wrestling, there's a lot of good, and there could also be a lot of bad. Have you had any independent wrestling horror stories since your time on the independents?
Oh, yeah. That happens here and there. I mean, there was an event a couple months ago that took place that I dubbed the Dubai debacle, which this new promoter tried to run a show out of Dubai, and basically the whole thing turned into a disaster. I mean, but I saw it from the very start, because he threw me out there to do press for the show, and he showed me the arena he was going to use, which was a 20,000-seat arena, and you could just tell the guy was in over his head. He didn't know what he was doing. But who am I to argue with a paid vacation to Dubai? You know what I'm saying? So, I went and did the press, and then I came back a month later, and, nobody got paid with the exception of a couple guys, including myself, and we didn't get paid our full fee. And he left a bunch of people without hotel rooms for the last night. So, I mean, it was chaos, man. And, there's been a couple situations like that. I mean, there was another one in New York where the guy didn't have the person who owned the building left with the funds, and then everybody was in the locker room, and it was really heated. The promoter was locked behind the door with all the wrestlers waiting. I was booked to a third party, so I got taken care of and I got out of there. But, I mean, that stuff happens, I mean, not everybody professional who tries to run a wrestling show. Some guys just don't know. They're in over their heads, or they don't know exactly how to budget it.
Yeah, I take the good with the bad.
Yeah. I mean, I can honestly, it's probably been about a handful of instances that were of that nature, or that level of, just bad situations.
All right, we have a couple fan questions that were mailed in specifically for you. Carl Metcalf would like to know, what was your favorite match during your WWE career?
Got to go with the Shawn Michaels pay-per-view match, Unforgiven, just because it was Shawn Michaels, and, what better than getting to work or compete against your childhood idol, I don't think anything will top that. I mean, literally, you could have put the world title and an opportunity to wrestle Shawn Michaels, opportunity to be world champion, and it kind of would almost balance out in my book. I mean, I'd like to obviously win a championship to go down in the record books, but wrestling Shawn was like the equivalent of that to me. It didn't get any higher than that, so that was will always stand out as probably my highlight moment.
How was Shawn to work with? Was he easy and pleasant, or was it the Shawn Michaels, the reputation you hear of from the 90s?
Oh, no, he was nothing like the 90s. I mean, after I gained his trust, everything was great. I mean, there was, once I started to work with him, there was one instance where we were on the outside of the ring, and it was a commercial break on Raw, and I had him picked up, like, in a body slam, and I was going to ram him into the post. And I remember I went and I go running towards the post, and, you know, I could hear it in his voice. He was like, tell me to slow down, kid, slow down. And, you know, I took him into the post, and I delivered it safely, though. You know, like, I brought it, and, like, I ran it fast, but then I put my hand between his back. And I think ever since that point, I gained his trust. And then from that point on, we worked some matches, and after he could see that, like, he was so easy to work. Cause, I mean, he's so over, obviously, that makes it easier. But also, and when you think about it, it's a guy you've watched your whole life, but you know what's coming with him. I mean, and, you know, and it makes you that much more fired up to go through the process. Like, you know, the moment when he gives you the flipper and he's about to make that nip up, I mean, I'm just as fired up as everybody else. It's almost like, you know, I'm a fan as well, but I'm having to participate in the action and stay professional. So, after I gained his trust, and after we've worked together a few times, he actually, and this was one of the biggest honors I think I've ever had, is he let me call all of our matches pretty much from that point on. So literally, you know, never finished it, and, you know, I'd go out there and call the rest, and, you know, anything that I ran by him was always ran in the, like, question format, though, just because I couldn't bring it to be like, hey, but, you know, do this. But it was great. That was really awesome, and it helped me gain a lot of confidence and really helped bring me along a lot in terms of my work. You know, I did obviously some things after that derailed me, but I think if I would have stayed on track from that point on, I could have developed and become the worker I eventually became much later on, like in 2011.
Brian Westcott from Meriden, Idaho, would like to know, what are your thoughts on the new WWE Network?
Well, you know, I don't know much about it outside of the pay-per-view package, which I think is great for hardcore wrestling fans, because I think the pay-per-view market is saturated so much. And I mean, if I was a fan to cop up $50 a month, every month for a pay-per-view, I mean, there's not much incentive. I don't think there'd be much incentive, because I just feel like everything moves so damn fast now. You know, it's like, I can tell you every pay-per-view before 1998, but then you go past that, and it's just like it all kind of, you know, bubbles together, with the exception of maybe a couple matches that stand out, you know? So I think it's great for the hardcore wrestling fan, because that way, you know, you have the network. I think pay-per-views, like I said, are included for, I don't know if it's an additional price, discounted price, but I think it's, like I said, primarily for, you know, the hardcore wrestling fan, I think it's probably one of the greatest things ever, in terms of not having to buy a pay-per-view every month and having a WWE network at your disposal. You know, there's a lot of wrestling junkies out there that I'm sure will sit around and watch that all day.
And his second question is, what are your thoughts on the Cauliflower Yowler Club?
I think it's great. I've only been a couple times. I wrestled one, but I mean, I'm all for paying respect and tribute to the guys that paved the way. I mean, again, I respect everybody who came before me, and it's really cool just to see. I mean, there's a lot of, I gotta be honest, I mean, there's some guys that go so far back that I don't even know, but, you know, just seeing these guys get back together and tell the stories of the good old days. I mean, yeah, wrestlers always have so many, you know, especially from that era, have so many crazy stories, because it was just such a wild, wild west before the WWE went public, and back there were territories that it makes for a fun atmosphere of just odd characters, because that's what wrestling is. It's, a bunch of big kids and odd characters, and, you know, and that's really what has made it interesting for so long, is just, you don't meet these type of people in your normal life. Like, when I come home, you know, it's a very different vibe than when I go on the road. It just, it feels like two different lives. You know, there's the, you know, the wrestling life, and once you enter that realm, and then there's normal life.
You mentioned good stories. That's going to bring us to our section of the show called Ribs, Rats, and Road Stories, where we ask you to share a legendary story involving some ribs or some rats on the road for Chris Masters.
Well, I've got my mom in attendance, so I'm happy to you know, there's always one that stands out, a story that was kind of funny when I was traveling with Randy Orton, and we were bumping some hip-hop music, and we had our bags piled in the back so we couldn't see out the rearview mirror, and we were running late for a house show, so I think I was driving. I don't know, one of us was driving, and we were going, you know, well above the speed limit, and at this one point, we decide we're going to pull over because we had to take a piss to make it stop, so we turn the music down, and then we hear these sirens behind us, and we're like, oh, what the hell? So we pull off the road, and then we pull over, and the cop comes out of the car. He's like, step out of the vehicle. Like, he's getting all crazy with us. And we're like, we're just completely, like, we didn't even know what the hell's going on. We didn't hear nothing. And then we come to realize that we had been in a high-speed chase for about 4 miles and had no idea. And so, luckily, the police officer made us pay the ticket right there, but I mean, it ended up being pretty crazy being involved in a high-speed chase and not even knowing it, because we were going about 80. So, and that's the way he described it to us, is he was saying he was about to call backup and get the helicopters.
Chris, this is producer Kid Remington here. I'm usually allowed to just, from behind the glass, ask a couple questions every show. Your master lock challenges, were you kind of brought in to kind of plan those out at the start, or was that pretty much just handed out to you and you know, go out there, make the most of that opportunity?
The mindset of the company at the time was to trail back on the, they pushed the envelope so far, so they wanted to make some, they wanted to bring back some of the traditional stuff to make it count.
Yep.
So, I mean, what's more traditional or old school than the full Nelson? I mean, it wasn't my pick, and I was a skeptic, kind of just like everybody else, because I figured in this day and age, I'm like, you know, it's not flashy enough. It's not, you know, it's not something that I would probably personally like as a fan. So, you know, I went in the whole time questioning it, but, so I can't take credit for the idea. I just know that when I came in, they wanted to have a finisher that I could use on people and, like, make it a challenge. But we didn't know what it was, and it eventually turned into the full Nelson and then the Master Lock Challenge. So, Hunter was the one who pushed for it to keep going, even when other people were questioning it. And, it just goes to show with the right amount of TV time and build, you can get things over as simple as a full Nelson or, you know, just about anything if it's given the time and the energy it needs. And, you know, to this day, people still react to it, which is a testament to that.
For sure. And I mean, you actually, on one of the earlier ones, you went against Sergeant Slaughter, who made a name for himself by having his Cobra Clutch Challenge for, I mean, weeks and weeks on television. So that was kind of a cool turn of events to see, you know, how things come around. Your character was, you know, I always saw Paul Orndorff in there. I always saw Hercules Hernandez, kind of with that combination, that power and that coolness. And I thought it was much needed. But when you got into more creative things, like I think it was Rosie or Viscera, a couple of the bigger guys, where at first you couldn't get the master lock on them, and then, you know, eventually through some turn of events you could get it on. You know, the crowd was definitely going in on that kind of stuff. And were you guys in the back kind of saying, you know what, now we've got something here? And
I think the master lock had, I mean, it was all a gradual build, and I think the peak for the move was once they made the Master Lock Challenge. It was, going into that program with Shawn Michaels, I think it was the Raw before maybe, but the main event of the Raw was a Master Lock Challenge. So yeah. I remember that day, and that was probably the best one. That was probably the best one ever, actually, because that was the one with the most fight in it, and it had the most build to it. But just for that to be the main event of a Raw was kind of the moment where I thought to myself, like, wow, this has really reached this got some cachet. You know, this is for this to be the main event of a Raw, and it's not a match. It's a full Nelson challenge, Master Lock challenge. I mean, that's kind of crazy when you think about it. So, I mean, I think that was the moment that stood out as like, wow, this move is really established now. And then, like, everything before that was, you know, just a gradual build every week. You know, every week built it up a little more until it was finally able to be put in that spot on a Monday Night Raw.
Yeah.
So, you know, which is astonishing. So, you know, and if you look back, it was pretty interesting. I mean, I can't say that Master Lock challenges, for the most part, were entertaining or asked you to look back at them, but that's one that you probably watch and look back at it and entertained by it. And it was well done, too. And, I mean, I know that I could tell my arms were turning purple from having to hold him in that thing. I mean, it's not as easy as it looks, you know, especially when you're fighting and struggling the way we were.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And I mean, it led to your program with Michaels, which was definitely a coming out party for you. Like, you guys had something really good there. Which, you know, through listening to you talk to Danny, it surprised me when you were saying that they were thinking about possibly a new package for you or a new persona. Did you guys have any meetings about that? Like, did they bring you in and say they were going to make you like the Matador or anything like that?
No. I mean, the extent of it was Hunter telling me fresh coat of paint is the words he used, which
okay.
is, you know, same thing as a repackaging. But, you know, I don't know if it would have been a complete repackaging, you know, or a refinement or a name change. I mean, I was trying to think of different ideas to pitch, you know, to Hunter. But I know that was brought up to me as like, you know, we need something. And because I did at the time, it's like my wrestling ability obviously come a long way, but it's like, you know, you can't go from being a guy that, you know, has been on Superstars or a guy who's lost, has a, you know, a majority of losses on the big program, and then push him out of nowhere like he's a main eventer. There has to be some kind of change, or maybe you got to be out of the eye, out of people's mind for a while, you know, something like that. But, you know, I had a few ideas, but we never got that far as to, you know, really playing around with, you know, what can we do, you know, which is one thing I regret. I probably should have went to Hunter more aggressively with ideas and different things rather than kind of biding my time and waiting to see what happened. But, yeah, it was kind of just left at that, you know what I mean? I was thinking of different ideas, whether it be just change my name to Masters, like, you know, or The Master, or doing a different gimmick in terms of, like, you know, I remember at one point I was even thinking about maybe being like one of those Tea Party radical people, or, you know, type of people that we have out here in America.
Yep.
That just, you know, comes out and, you know, talks about how wrong, how terrible our country is and how it needs to change. I think it's kind of similar to the gimmick that they ended up doing with Swagger, I think, a little bit, and the guy he's with.
Before we wrap things up here, what can people expect when they come see the Masterpiece Chris Masters live and in person February 19th through 23rd, a part of your debut with Canadian Wrestling's Elite?
Oh, maximum smileage all the way. Guaranteed good times or your money back. But no, honestly, you know, I don't hold anything back. I go out there and I give the people their money's worth. And, you know, I just guarantee anybody who will watch, who will come to these shows, that you will not be disappointed. They're going to be entertaining. And, you know, I'll, just as I do every night I go out, I'm going to give it everything I have and make sure that they leave there satisfied and fulfilled. And, you know, it's gonna be some action, man. We got five shows.
Five shows in 5 days.
Five shows in 5 days, man. It's time to get to work. So yeah, come on down. It's gonna be excitement. It's gonna be theater. It's gonna be all of that.
Perfect. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your schedule to join us today. Pack up that warm clothes. Get ready. You're coming to Winnipeg. We're gonna have some fun next week.
I'll bring my onesie and a scarf and some earmuffs. We'll be all good.
And that's going to wrap up this edition of Elite Wrestling Radio. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back next Wednesday.